This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has called for a 90-day reduction in violence in Afghanistan and a United Nations-led peace effort as he warns the United States could withdraw all forces after May 1st. That's according to a letter to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. The letter from Blinken was first published by Otolo News, an Afghan news outlet, and confirmed by the New York Times. State Department spokeswoman declined to confirm the letter's veracity, but said that the United States has not made any decisions about the force posture in Afghanistan after May 1st. On Saturday, Afghanistan's Taliban said its leaders have restarted peace talks with the United States. A spokesman for the Islamist insurgent group said the meeting took place Friday night in Doha, where Taliban official Abdul Ghani Bardar and U.S. peace envoy Zalmay Khalilzad led their respective teams. The Taliban have rejected Afghan President Ashraf Ghani's government as an illegal entity and product of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. Yemen's Houthi forces fired missiles Sunday at the heart of Saudi Arabia's oil industry, attacking a Saudi Aramco facility in an assault the kingdom said was aimed at the security and stability of the global energy supply. A Houthi spokesperson said that the group has launched 14 drones and fired 8 ballistic missiles in a wide operation in the heart of Saudi Arabia. The Houthis recently stepped up cross-border attacks on Saudi Arabia at a time when the United States and the United Nations are pushing for a ceasefire to revive stalled political negotiations to end the war. This is VOA News. South Korea will increase its contribution to the cost of U.S. forces stationed in the country under an agreement reached with the United States, according to the State Department. A State Department spokeswoman said the agreement reflects the Biden administration's commitment to modernizing its democratic alliances around the world to advance shared security and prosperity. The spokeswoman said the agreement includes a meaningful increase in host nation support contributions, but she gave no further details. There are about 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in South Korea. Pakistani officials said Sunday the gunman ambushed a vehicle transporting Navy personnel in southwestern Gwadar district, killing at least one sailor and seriously wounding two others. A minister for the province of Balochistan told VOA the assailants targeted the Pakistani Navy vehicle with automatic weapons Saturday evening near the coastal town of Jawani. The district is home to a Chinese-run deepwater port. It's a centerpiece of the multi-billion-dollar China-Pakistan economic corridor. They condemned the incident as a terrorist attack, saying personnel from the Navy's quick response force were on board the vehicle. The Balochistan Liberation Army, which the United States has declared a global terrorist group, took responsibility for the attack. It claimed the shooting killed 4 Navy officers and wounded 2 others, although the group's claims are often inflated. The Ivory Coast main opposition party on Sunday claimed victory in a legislative election, alleging that preliminary results were riddled with irregularities. Saturday's vote was a key test of stability 4 months after violence around a disputed presidential poll claimed 87 lives in the former French colony. A top official with the center-right Ivory Coast Democratic Party said his party is concerned that the results may have been manipulated and warned the government against any attempt to falsify them. Iran has released a British-Iranian aid worker from house arrest after the end of her 5-year prison sentence, but a lawyer says she has been summoned to court again on another charge. The project manager with the Thomson Reuters Foundation was arrested at a Tehran airport in April 2016 and later convicted of plotting to overthrow the clerical establishment. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, March 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. It appears today's call for a mass protest in Senegal may be averted.
We just saw the press conference organized by the representative of the religious leaders. Apparently, now we are heading to a kind of solution. The government is accepting not to lock up the leader of the opposition.
Nigerian President Buhari pays tribute to a passing Supreme Court justice. On this International Women's Day, a new report says women are still underrepresented in parliaments worldwide, an initiative for empowering Kenyan women. And Cameroon's military is accused of killing civilians in new attacks on separatists.
They should carry an investigation because the same scenario happened in Garbo last year, and then they said it was a surprise at the end. After investigation, it was the military. So let them carry other investigation.
And 1 year into the COVID-19 pandemic, many Kenyans are still struggling with poverty and unemployment. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Appears there has been an apparent intervention by Senegalese religious leaders in that country's political crisis that was sparked by the arrest of opposition politician Ousmane Sonko. Sonko was arrested March 3rd for holding an alleged illegal rally while on his way to court to answer charges of alleged rape. The arrest sparked days of protest, resulting in the deaths of at least five people and the ransacking of several police stations. The opposition alliance, known as Movement for the Defense of Democracy, had called for a mass protest today, Monday. However, Senegalese political analyst Ibrahima Kan says opposition leader Sonko may be released today, Monday, following the intercession of religious leaders.
Senegal is a country with its whole traditional system of solving problems. And I think for the cause of the unprecedented dimension of this crisis, the religious leaders started to really get more involved in the situation. And we just saw the press conference organized by the representative of the religious leaders who were explaining a kind of agreement they reached with both the government and the opposition. So apparently now we are heading to a kind of solution. The government is accepting not to lock up the leader of the opposition because he's supposed to go tomorrow to see the investigative judge. After the meeting with the investigators judge, certainly he will be released to go home.
The opposition Movement for Defense of Democracy had called for a protest today, Monday. Is it likely that the protest will take place?
I don't know if it's likely that the protest will remain, but I know for sure because I was watching a program where women organizations, both from that opposition movement and civil society, decided that tomorrow, because it's Women's Day, they will work together to show that it's women's problem and that it won't be a kind of demonstration, but it will be a rally for all of them. They want women to play an important role in the current crisis. And I think that's also show that there are willingness from both sides to really calm the situation at the moment. They insisted that they will rally. Now, finally, people agree that, yes, the rally can be joint rally for women from both sides and to start really campaigning for peace in the country.
The intervention you talked about of these religious leaders, where does that put the demands of the opposition, for example, release of political prisoners, also the allegations against Ousmane Sonko? Where would that put the opposition?
You know, the Ousmane Sonko case is a legal case on court. The religious leaders cannot stop that. But at least the idea is Ousmane Sonko, because he's a well-known person, he can go back home. And that procedure will continue. But all the people who were arrested during the crisis will be released. That is apparently the kind of agreement they've reached, which also meet demand of the opposition.
And of course, schools are also closed in Senegal. Is that correct?
Schools are closed. I think it was a preventive measure, but I don't think that they will change the decision because, you know, they're closing the school because there was a call for demonstration and they know that children are let to go to on the street. That will really change the dynamic in the country.
Ibrahim Akar is a Senegalese political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dakar. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has paid tribute to Supreme Court Justice Sylvester Nguta, who passed away early Sunday. Galba Shehu, Senior Special Assistant to President Buhari on Media and Publicity, says President Buhari believes Justice Nguta's passing leaves a void on the Supreme Court because of his experience.
Justice Nwali Sylvester Nguta, his passing came as a shock because this is a justice of the court who has barely a few months to finish his term when he gets to the age of 70. As nature would have it, he has given up the ghost and sadly has left. But he left behind a record of very competent and articulate interpretation of the Constitution. And the president of Nigeria is saying his death would obviously leave a gap in the Supreme Court, considering his experience and dedication to the interpretation of the Constitution.
Shehu, Justice Nguta was in 2018, I think, accused of corrupt practices. Was he forced to retire because of this?
No. Those things, I think everyone has put those issues behind themselves because you can see that he had resumed his seat in the Supreme Court and had carried on with his duties until this unfortunate departure at this time. He, as a justice of the Supreme Court, by law, must retire at the age of 70. And I must say that even at 70 is an improvement following an approval earlier given by the Nigerian government that they could serve up to 70 years. Before now, they had served up to 65 years and they left service.
Has there been any information in terms of what he died from?
No, we have not been made aware of that. But certainly, we are not aware that he died of COVID, which most people will rush into assuming. Nothing to indicate COVID at this time.
The president did say something about the herdsmen. I read also about them carrying weapons. What did the president say?
The president has given an order to all criminals wielding weapons such as the AK-47 rifles illegally. They are not law enforcement agencies found in the forest. Bandits, herdsmen, whoever they are, they should be shot if they don't disarm.
Shehu, of course, today, Monday, is International Women's Day. I think I might have read in one of the Nigerian papers where the president was touting his support for women in his government.
Well, the idea is to present the evidence because it's not just enough to say we are promoting women and they are occupying the center stage in the affairs of the country. People will ask, who are they? Where are they? So this is why we took the unprecedented step of publishing a litany of women promoted to very high government positions, including ministers, government advisors, and the chief executives of government agencies. We believe that this is to demonstrate the fact that the president walks his talk.
Galba Shehu is the special assistant to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. Cameroonians are complaining of increasing human rights abuses as the Central African state intensifies raids on English-speaking rebel camps. The military says within the past week, at least 23 separatist rebels and 3 soldiers have been killed. But local people said most of those killed were unarmed civilians. The military is denying the accusations. As Moki Edwin Kinzinga reports from Yaounde, there are growing calls for investigations of alleged human rights abuses by the Cameroon military.
General Valenka, commander of the Cameroonian troops fighting separatists in the English-speaking northwest region, says within the past 7 days, 400 troops have attacked at least 15 separatist camps. Nkar says in Bui, an English-speaking administrative unit in the northwest region, more than 15 rebels were killed and hundreds of weapons seized. He says he has instructed the military to remain professional and respect human rights as they destroy all separatist camps and kill rebel fighters who refuse to drop their weapons. He says people should cooperate with troops risking their lives to protect civilians. He says peace must return to Cameroon's English-speaking regions. Nkas said two soldiers were killed and another died after a roadside bomb damaged a military vehicle in the town of Kumbu. Nkas said a self-proclaimed separatist general called Assan died during the raids while 11 rebel fighters were arrested. Separatists have acknowledged the attacks and the killing of their general on social media. They also acknowledged that one of their fighters surrendered, but said only three fighters died. 32-year-old honey seller Ernest Kebam fled from Oku, a district in the northwest region, on March 3. He says he does not trust the military claims that troops respect human rights. He spoke via a messaging app from Douala.
They should carry an investigation because the same scenario happened in Garbo last year, and then they said it was a separatist at the end. After investigation, was the military. Up north was the same scenario. They said it was not the military that was Boko Haram that attacked, and after investigation, it was a military. So let them carry out their investigation.
Joseph Vincent Tuda Ebode is a lecturer in international security and defense at the University of Yaoundé, SUA. He says Cameroon, as a signatory to all human rights conventions, should conduct an independent investigation of claims of abuses by its troops. Moki Edwin Kinzaka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, March 8. A report coinciding with International Women's Day today, March 8, finds that the number of women parliamentarians globally is increasing, but so slightly that it barely dents the global male-dominated system. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Inter-Parliamentary Union reports more than one quarter of the world's parliamentarians are women. However, at the current rate of progress, the IPU says it will take another 50 years before gender parity is achieved. Rwanda, Cuba, and the United Arab Emirates were the three top-ranked countries in 2020, accounting for 50% or more female members. The IPU attributes much of this success to gender quotas. On average, it notes, parliaments with quotas have elected nearly 12% more women to lower chambers and 7.4% more women to upper chambers. IPU Secretary General Martin Chungong says discrimination against women prevents them from becoming parliamentarians. In some cases, he says, governments have laws that prevent women from running for office.
We have, in the recent years, brought to light the phenomenon of violence against women. And there's ample evidence out there that women are now refraining from entering the dangerous terrain of politics on account of harassment, sexism, and outright violence, which is something we need to combat.
The IPU report finds progress has been made in all regions of the world. It says the Americas once again tops all other regions, with women making up 32.4% of MPs. This, the report says, was despite political upheaval across Latin America. It notes women represented nearly 27% of membership in the U.S. Congress, the highest level in its history. In sub-Saharan Africa, the report finds Mali and Niger have made significant gains in women's representation, despite grave security risks. It says a few countries in Europe have achieved 30% female representation, while the Middle East and North Africa have lagged with 17%. The worst performing countries are in the Asia-Pacific region. The IPU says Vanuatu and Papua New Guinea have no female representation, Cameroon. IPU officials call this a matter of great concern. The report shows the COVID-19 pandemic had a negative impact on elections last year, noting that national parliamentary elections were postponed in nearly 20 countries due to restrictions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As the world marks International Women's Day today, Monday, amid the COVID-19 pandemic, we take a look this morning at Kenyan women who are bridging the gap by coming up with initiatives geared towards empowering women. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA.
According to the report by the United Nations Development Program on International Women's Day, women must have the opportunity to play a full role in shaping the fundamental decisions being made right now as countries respond to and recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. And during this pandemic, a Kenyan lady, Bella Chieng, founder of Bella Rafiki Foundation from Homa Bay County in western region of the country, has put up a fully furnished library as well as an agricultural group for widows. All this is to ensure women and youths in the society are empowered.
We do poultry and livestock keeping. We grow crops such as sweet potatoes, maize, and groundnuts. Then we sell them locally. And this way, the widows who are in my foundation are able to fend for themselves. How I came up with an idea of making a library, it is an idea that came from the widows. They saw that this is a problem in our community. And for them, knowledge is power. So we built the first ever library that is going to serve this whole community.
Bella says insecurity in the area is a setback as some community members are making it difficult for the initiative to run efficiently as some are stealing materials meant for the projects.
Challenges that we've faced so far are financial and insecurity. This comes in where some of the community members themselves are getting into the library and stealing the books even before we did the launching.
The United Nations says countries must break the deep-rooted historic, cultural, and socioeconomic barriers that prevent women from taking their seat at the decision-making table to ensure that resources and power are equitably distributed. Another lady, Sheila Kinuthia, founder of Phoenix Halfway House, was falsely accused and imprisoned, but later acquitted. She came up with Halfway House to help women who go through domestic violence and those released from prison to be in a position to fend for themselves by helping them to secure jobs.
I started the Halfway House because I met a lot of those women in prison. We deal with women who are from violent domestic relationships, women coming from prison who have no other place to go. So it's a transitional home, and it lasts, their stay there is 3 months or less. We give them training for jobs. We also give them counseling until their next destination.
On the other hand, a communication specialist, Sheila Raymond, who has written stories on girls from the slums in Kenya, has come up with a plan to help girls who perform in school continue to pursue their dreams. She does this by paying school fees for them.
Many parents living in the slums are not able to support their children through high school. And so what I decided is I am going to pay school fees for at least three girls in all the schools that have dance mentorship sessions. I do this from my own pocket. I don't have any donor so far, but I hope in future I will be able to get someone who will be able to come and join me, and so that we can be able to reach many more girls.
The United Nations says structural discrimination such as persistent gender stereotypes and gendered expectations, norms, and attitudes remains a significant barrier in equality between women and men. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
1 year into the COVID-19 pandemic in Kenya, thousands of families are struggling with deepening poverty and unemployment. A survey by the charity Twaweza shows that 60% of Kenyan families can no longer afford three meals per day. Brenda Molinya reports from Nairobi.
In her one-bedroom house just on the outskirts of Nairobi, Rebecca Adagala prepares vegetables for the day's dinner. It is the only meal she and her grandchildren can afford in a day. A year ago, things were different for Adagala. She earned enough from her grocery store job to ensure that her family was well fed. Now, though 1 year after COVID-19 struck Kenya, Adagala can barely afford one meal a day. She says sometimes she only has water to drink for her supper, and if she is lucky, a family member who hasn't lost their job buys corn flour for the family's meals. The Kenyan government's efforts to contain the spread of COVID-19 with lockdowns have led to rising unemployment. More than 1.7 million people lost their jobs in the first 4 months of the pandemic. A survey by Toweza, a non-governmental group, shows that in the last 6 months of 2020, more Kenyans were more worried about where their next meal would come from. James Gishira, a director with Toweza, says the situation is dire.
7 out of 10 of the households say that they fear economic impact much more than health impact.
A food pantry run by a charity group in Kenya is in high demand as people without jobs cannot feed themselves. Nowhere is the need greater than in the informal settlements, says the charity director John Gadungu.
We are not able even to go there freely to distribute the food that we used to distribute, because you found since most people are not going to work, they remained in the villages and in their houses. So when there is, they hear that there is food being distributed, there is almost some stopping.
Even though Kenya's coronavirus containment measures have hurt the economy, the government, through its spokesman Cyrus Oguna, says it is determined to balance the scales by keeping the public safe while also ensuring that people are able to put food on their tables.
The government has also been able to set programs to, you know, put money in the pockets of those who have lost their livelihoods by initiating a weekly stipend.
Many like Adagala, however, they have not yet received this government stipend. Brenda Mulinya for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport in Mauritania, where Black Satellites of Ghana are the new under-20 African champions after beating Uganda 2-0 in the Mauritanian capital of Nouakchott on Saturday to win their first African under-20 championship title in 10 years. Two goals from Dana Baria Afria proved the difference, scoring in each half to sink a Ugandan side seeking the country's first African title at any level. The Black Satellites are now four times champions of the competition. Coach Mure Biekwaso of Uganda Hippos was delighted with his Hippos' performance despite losing the trophy to Ghana.
We have to thank God for this. 1 year from the tournament, the Kafa is a coach, then bringing the team for the first time, and I reach finals. I'm so happy, and I really thank God for this. I really need to be positive.
And now to the CAF Champions League, where matches were played across various venues on the continent this past weekend. Al Ahly were held to a 2-2 draw by AS Vita Club in Group A at the Cairo International Stadium on Saturday night. The draw left Egyptian champions Al Ahly placed third on the Group A standings, while DR Congo Giant are placed second on the log. In the other Group A match played on Saturday, surprise Group A frontrunners Simba of Tanzania followed up a home victory over defending champions Al Ahly by drawing 0-0 with El Merrikh of Sudan in Omdurman. El Merrikh, bottom of the table with only 1 point from three outings, sacked Tunisian coach Nasreddine Nabi after the match. In Group B, South African club Mamelodi Sundowns ended the 7-4 match unbeaten home record in African competitions of Democratic Republic of Congo team TP Mazembe with a 2-1 victory. CR Belouizdad and Al Hilal Omdurman played out to a 1-1 draw in Algeria in the other Group B match on Friday evening. And now to Group C, where third place Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa won for the first time in Group C, delivering a 2-0 victory over Angolan visitors Petro Atletico. Wydad Casablanca in the other Group C game secured a 2-0 win over Horoya AC of Guinea. The win saw the Moroccan Giants open a 5-point lead at the top of Group C standings, while Guinean champions Horoya remained second on the table. And finally, in Group D, Osporons of Tunisia emerged 3-1 victors over fellow heavyweight Zamalek of Egypt. Osporons top Group D now with 7 points. Mouloudia Alja of Algeria have 5 after 1-0 win at bottom of the table. Tenouet of Senegal and Zamalek only 2 points. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, March 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a